Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 21st, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Dan Spencer, continuing his series, Ethics and the Earth. Today's session is number 5 and is titled, Ecofeminism, Connections Between Ecology and Feminism. Let's listen in.
My name is Dan Spencer, and this is the 5th in a 5-part series on ethics and the earth. The title of this session is Ecofeminism, Connections Between Ecology and Feminism. The bulk of this session is going to be about a 30-35 minute video that has just come out in the last few months called Ecofeminism Now, which I've watched a few times and find a delightful introduction to what ecofeminism is and how it works. Those of you who have been in and out this week know we've been started at the beginning of the week with some brief discussion about what is ecological ethics, why it's emerging in our time, and then what the last few sessions have been some different approaches. On Wednesday, we looked at the approach of stewardship as one model of responding to environmental issues that has come out of the biblical tradition especially. Then yesterday, we looked at a couple different models called bioregionalism. It says our ethics of response should be located in our place of where we're living, adapting human culture to the rhythms of nature, as well as deep ecology. Deep ecology says we have to overcome the subject-object split that sees each of us as individualized persons and egos against the generalized nature and continue to expand our identification with nature of all of us participating within nature as part of that. Today's model, ecofeminism, it does a couple different things. It's emerged in the last 20 years from women involved in both the ecological movement and in feminism, and beginning to see the linkage, the links between how women have been oppressed and viewed in society and how nature has been oppressed and viewed in society. From things as basic as the fact that oftentimes we use feminine images of nature, virgin timber, Mother Earth, the rape of the land, these kinds of images that are out there that feminize nature, and how does that function both symbolically as well as in our practices, to a much more deeply analytical approach of how we have created what we're talking about as naturalized hierarchies of order, and what have been some of the sources of man above woman, above animals, above trees, above rocks, seeing hierarchy as somehow intrinsic to the natural order of things. So I want to do a whole lot more introduction, let you watch the video here. Maybe just a couple things. We've been using these sort of three spectrums of approaches here. How many folks today is this your first time in one of these sessions? Okay, we've got enough that I'll just briefly review them here because it'll help us understand what ecofeminism is trying to do. These are three primary questions that are emerging in terms of when we think about how to respond to environmental issues and ecological degradation. The first one is a spectrum sometimes called between anthropocentrism and either ecocentrism or biocentrism. Anthropocentric positions put human beings at the center of our response. We need to preserve the environment because human beings depend on it. Human well-being depends on it, and therefore it's a human-centered response. It locates primary value in human beings, both individuals and communities, and sees other parts of nature primarily in their usefulness to human beings. Ecocentrism and biocentrism argues that all of life has value, and therefore, rather than making human beings the center point of our reference, we as human beings need to fit ourselves into a much larger center of reference, that is, ecosystems in general, what's an appropriate place within that. And we'll see that many ecofeminisms find themselves along this spectrum, although more towards the biocentric side. A second question that emerges a lot is whether we should focus primarily on the individual worth of individuals, or the moral worth of individuals, whether those are human individuals or other forms of life, such as animals. Or should we focus primarily on the well-being of the community, on ecosystems, on habitats, on natural systems? And therefore, there may be cases where deep ecology would argue, for example, that individual interests have to be sacrificed to the well-being of the whole. We've got roughly 6 billion people on Earth now. That's too many. Remember, we're going to have to sacrifice human interests in order to get a sustainable whole. And the final, and what we'll look at is, I think, Ecofeminism has a very interesting response to this debate, and we'll talk about it after we watch the video. Then the final one is, should we work primarily within the system to reform it, or is the system itself the problem, and therefore we need to transform the system, create a new alternative, both culturally and socioeconomically? That's not real clear yet. We'll come back and work with it more afterwards, but that will give you some grounding. And then we'll watch this. And what I'd like you to pay attention to, a couple different things in here. Notice not only the content of the video, but the form, because that's very important to ecofeminism as well. And so just the way the video itself spins out, what are the images, what are the metaphors, the way they connect themes. And then also the diversity of positions. Ecofeminism is a broad category with many positions within it. And so see if you can begin to notice some of the differences within it here. I'll turn off the lights.
This is our home. The first people who lived here saw the land, plants, and animals as part of their family, alive with the spirit of the Creator. Later, other people came here to possess the land and its inhabitants. And later still, their descendants began to question the traditions they'd inherited. Some began to look for new, or very old, ways of living,
and
cherished our human relationships with each other and with the land. Today, women are looking for their own histories of environmental activism, and finding it in figures like Rachel Carson, whose work criticized Western culture's increasingly toxic attempts to control nature. Around the world, women are building a movement in defense of the earth.
I believe that we need to redefine what is the environmental movement in this country, and that grassroots communities working on not in my backyard toxics, that, you know, the woman who at SAC and Fox went out and stopped a tribal council from approving a nuclear waste research contract, Grace Thorpe, that, you know, these Indian women in northern Saskatchewan that stopped the tribal council from agreeing to a land deal that would have caused clear cutting, are the environmental movement too. I believe that a lot of grassroots organizing is undertaken by women.
Of course, the thing that really stirred me very much into this kind of thinking, the fact that when you really come to think of it, who battles around the forest, who battles around the toxic dump? It's very ordinary women. Extremely ordinary women who get tremendous, extraordinary strength just from the fact that they care so deeply. And that has been the backbone of the environmental movement.
Beginning in 1980 with the Women and Life on Earth Conference and the Women's Pentagon Action, a number of eco-feminist conferences and organizations have taken shape. In July 1994, women gathered at the Institute for Social Ecology to discuss the convergence of movements on behalf of women, people of color, and the Earth. We began with an exploration of the word that had brought many of us here, ecofeminism.
Terms like ecofeminism are really useful as a kind of shorthand and as a way to rally and to feel connected and to feel an affinity. And they're not necessary. And sometimes they're off-putting to people who are doing things very powerfully and feel like the term means you're an academic who is making this heavy analysis, but you're not really out there working with real people.
One time I was reading the newsletter from the Citizens Clearinghouse on Toxic Waste, and the president's letter by Lois Gibb, president's column by Lois Gibb, was very ecofeminist. And so I just telephoned her out of the blue, and I introduced myself, and I said, you know, I read this column, and I just wonder, do you self-identify as an ecofeminist? And Lois Gibb said, oh yes, absolutely. But very few of the women in this national network do, because they don't want the word feminist. They would say, oh, those are people who hate men. And they don't want the word ecologist or environmentalist, because they say, oh, those are people who care more about bunnies and deer than people. So many of them identify as a community activist. and they don't want the label, but she feels what they're doing is ecofeminist work as she understands it, and I agree.
I guess people would probably call themselves ecofeminists if asked, but people don't really think of it in those terms, I don't think. I mean, we're just a community that's defending the earth and battling against this corporation. You know, we're defending both the human and non-human parts of our community against the assault of this corporation.
Weighing our ideas and experiences, women have begun to shape by hand a language and a movement. The raw materials of ecofeminism are familiar to women from many walks of life. A love for the earth and the animals of this earth. A deep belief in justice and a conviction that as humans, we are not separate from the rest of nature. Each one of us is interconnected with all life on earth. And from that felt sense of interconnection comes the desire to communicate these ideas, to let these ideas take shape.
I have had hundreds of women come up to me since I, in the years since I wrote Green Paradise Lost, and been lecturing about it, and said to me in variations of, you put into words what I felt for many years, you've written the book that I couldn't write but would have liked to.
After the ecofeminist conference at USC in 1987, Ms. had just a little write-up about it. They got all these letters saying, I've never heard this, but I know this is for me. Ecofeminism, yes, this is what I do in my community. I'm an ecofeminist. It was an amazing response, but to my amazement, at least, the term had a lot of power to people who heard it because they had already thought through this connection.
Ecofeminism resonated with memories from childhood and enabled me, empowered me, encouraged me to reclaim those things that had started in childhood, perhaps never reached fruition.
Though I came to ecofeminism first through the written word, actually it was a really good, in Judith Plant's book, the poem called Just Simply Tampons, where it talked about women bleeding on the stairs of legislature and corporations. I thought this is really cool.
And it was actually personally for me a rock climbing experience that made me an ecofeminist, where I realized that within a span of a few days, my beliefs and values not only had changed, but my behavior toward a rock changed. Well, I see the movement as growing both out of a grassroots need to keep our communities clean, out of an intellectual understanding of the connection between isms of domination, of a political praxis understanding that the Greens and the women's movement and the anti-nuke movement and the anti-racism movement had a common agenda at some level, and from personal experience. Feminism and the Revolt of Nature began thinking about the relationship between these things. Ecofeminism was a term that I came up with. It's a sort of obvious term in a way, you know, that when you put these things together, that's the word that makes sense or to talk about them. And I understood later, really shortly thereafter, that Francois Duvon in France had also used this term ecofeminism. And Mary Daly came out with Gynecology, in which she used the term ecofeminism as well, right around the same time.
I think probably ecofeminism started to develop as a theory because of the way in which animals and the environment were neglected by discussions within feminism, and at the same time, women's issues were neglected by environmentalists. And ecofeminism started as a way of trying to be more inclusive as an environmental theory and as a feminist theory.
Many people have asked various ecofeminists how to define ecofeminism, and we seem to define it differently depending upon our perspectives. The one thing I've noticed is that we have one set of beliefs we seem to all be committed to,
And that's the belief that they're intimate and not just accidental connections between how you treat women and how you treat the earth. And that a failure to see those connections results in bad feminism, results in bad environmentalism,
I think that ecofeminism has been a way, a form in which women can articulate these very logical and important understandings of how male power has gotten into the planet. It's really given a language to that. Radical feminism wasn't focused on that. You know, it's a question of emphasis or focus. I don't think it's necessarily one is more evolved than the other. I think that it makes a lot of sense that in the 90s, when ecological crises are coming to ahead, that we would have ecofeminism. It sort of speaks to the anxieties and the concerns of today.
While people come to ecofeminism from different paths of activism and spirituality, feminism has provided the defining contours. Imagine the several varieties of feminism as if they were mapped onto the land itself. From these mountains of feminist thought, various streams have contributed to the lake of ideas that is ecofeminism. One stream of ecofeminism emphasizes the importance of animals to both feminism and ecofeminism. These ecofeminists work to bridge the animal liberation, feminist, and environmental movements by pointing to their shared histories and their shared concerns.
The history of feminism, there are a number of feminists who've been very concerned about animal issues and concerned about nature in the broad sense is more about 20th century phenomenon, but if you go back to someone like Mary Wollstonecraft, considered probably the first major Western feminist theorist, she was very concerned about animal issues. And you go on through, I mean, in 19th century feminists were, the majority of them were either concerned about diet, vegetarianism. Certainly the majority were concerned about animal welfare issues. The anti-vivisection movement of the 19th century was largely populated by women. So there is a whole history there of feminist involvement and concern with animal issues. So it's not something new.
Historically, the animal rights movement and the environmental movement have come from different arenas. And for me, they're both movements of compassion. I mean, that's how I conceive them. So I think of them as inherently united. Mm-hmm. And I think that practically, there are many areas where it's just so obvious that they are united. And I think it's important for us to start looking at those commonalities. And I think certainly vegetarianism is an important way in which both movements can be united, because the tremendous ecological destruction of the meat-based diet and because of the inherent cruelty to animals.
Vegetarianism is an act of resistance. It resists killing animals, first of all. It resists plundering the earth. Animal-based agriculture is highly exploitative of the earth, as well as of the workers who must kill the animals, as well as of the animals themselves.
Anarchist feminism has critiqued all forms of hierarchy, and this stream, influenced by social ecology, has led to social ecofeminism, which looks at how relations between humans shape the way that humans relate to nature.
As a social ecofeminist, I see things, I have an ecological perspective that's informed by social ecology. And social ecology looks at social crises and tries to understand how an ecological perspective awakens us to the idea of our role and our participation in creating natural history. Humanity has not destroyed the planet. 1% of humanity has destroyed the planet and plundered the planet. I get very frustrated when I hear people saying that, oh, humanity has had its way long enough, and now it's time for nature to take its course, so let's just let nature alone. The fact is, when people, the only people I notice making those sorts of statements are usually very privileged white men and women, mostly men who are making those sorts of statements. The fact is that 99% of humanity is plundered along with nature, you know, in most ecological catastrophes and in most social catastrophes.
So the question isn't really, is it going to be an ecological society? You know, are we going to let nature finally have its way? Or is it going to be a social society? The fact is, we have to liberate all of all people, and we all these people now have to live in harmony with the planet. So it has to be a social, ecological movement. It has to be a feminist, anti-racist movement. It has to be an anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchy movement. It has to be a movement that's committed to getting rid of the toxin of domination and hierarchy, as well as toxins such as CFCs and all sorts of monstrous, Frankensteinian, nightmarish substances that men have put on the planet.
Socialist feminism exposes the social structures which operate to ensure that women, people of color, and the working classes receive the fewest resources and hold the least amount of power in Western industrialized culture. This branch of ecofeminism emphasizes the ways that social structures shape human identities and experiences, associating women with nature in a way that authorizes our dual subordination.
When we are simultaneously ecological and feminist, what we're trying to do is not look so much at what women are, but how dominant power perceives them and manipulates structures to exclude, violate, dominate, and to see how closely the attitudes to women are related to attitudes to nature, and how violence against women and the ecological crisis mimic each other all the time.
Unlike the early 60s, feminism can't be seen, nor could ecofeminism, in my point of view, as a shared experience, as movement. Because there may be points at which the only one in the movement is the individual, me, or you, or her, because there are experiences I have that you don't have that I think are relevant to my ecofeminism. And so I think bell hooks is quite right. A shared experience movement is an ethnocentric movement, potentially racist and classist. And what you need is a shared beliefs movement. And men don't get let off the hook on that one. They can get these beliefs. And in fact, I think they're morally obligated to get these beliefs. And yet they can't be female.
Feminism, developed specifically by women of color, sometimes called womanism, contributes to both the spiritual and the political aspects of ecofeminism. Both radical and womanist ecofeminists have emphasized the significance of woman-centered spirituality. But within ecofeminism, there has been much debate over the relationship between spirituality and politics, a debate which some find unnecessary.
There's a spiritual dimension to my form of ecofeminism, as well as a political dimension. I have to say, I'm really dismayed, though, over the kind of fighting we've experienced in the last few years between these two contingents of ecofeminism, between the hard-headed political types and the spiritual types.
There's a lot of people that come more out of the old left traditions that have inherited the Marxist idea that spirituality is, first of all, they don't distinguish between spirituality and religion, and then say that religion is the opiate of the people, which is a bit of an arrogant position on religion, much less spirituality. And this, the role that religion has played in, for instance, the African-American movement, the Native American movement, I mean, most disenfranchised folks of color don't have the split between spirituality and religion.
But I do believe that Earth-based spiritual practice is how we renew, strengthen, and retain our relationship with the earth. And I believe we have a responsibility to do that, each of us individually, and collectively as societies and cultures.
Both woman and man are both natural and spiritual, and nature itself is imbued with spirituality in the sense that the ancients saw it. We call it animism, but in truth they recognized what scientists today call the Gaia hypothesis, Gaia being, of course, one of the ancient names for the Mother Goddess, that this is a living, interconnected, organic whole that we're dealing with.
All of these emphases within ecofeminism share a common belief that social justice and environmental justice are inseparably linked. To achieve these goals, ecofeminists agree that a social and economic transformation is needed. Because liberal feminism is not focused on transforming, but simply correcting the present system, liberal feminism has not contributed to ecofeminism's reconstructive vision. Nonetheless, activists often use liberal strategies as effective short-term solutions, and numerous stopgap reforms are needed along the path to social transformation. Taken together, all these varieties of ecofeminism strive to offer a panoramic view of our current situation, one that is both feminist and ecological. Ecofeminism offers a vision for reconstructing society in balance with nature.
You know, I think part of what has interested a lot of people in ecofeminism during the 80s is, you know, the reconstructive or visionary or alternative possibilities. You know, in the context where a lot of the feminist theory that's been done is, you know, is deconstructive rather than reconstructive. And so, you know, in that sense, feminism needs, and any social movement needs, vision.
Ecofeminists have been active in fighting toxics and biotechnology, building coalitions between labor activists and environmentalists, and contributing to the movements for environmental justice and indigenous rights. There's a variety of ecofeminist actions, building community, fighting back against oppression, and bringing an awareness of our interconnected struggles to every part of our work.
Eve, which is Ecofeminist Visions Emerging, got started around February of 91 when my twin sister Colleen and I realized that we wanted more community. We were moving towards a space in feminism that we hadn't seen elsewhere. And so what we decided was that if we can't find the kind of feminist community that we wanted, which we had come to find out was ecofeminism, then we would create it ourselves.
For nearly 3 years, Eve activists met once a month in a study group to discuss readings they had chosen to learn together. These discussions were printed up in a newsletter which was distributed internationally, but Eve activists did several other things as well.
One was a guerrilla graffiti group that got together once a month, and it was one of the funnest things I've ever done in my whole life. Women would come together and armed with our magic markers, and we would just walk around the city, and in New York there's plenty of billboards, and we would correct misogynist advertising. And on the spot, we would see a billboard and we'd sort of deconstruct it, what's going on here, and then we'd put on our advertising happy hat and we would change it.
In 1982, Marty Keel, along with a few other women, founded Feminists for Animal Rights, a group which now has 8 regional centers across the U.S. One of their recent projects is a foster care program for the companion animals of women who are the victims of domestic violence.
My history as a feminist has been in working in the battered women's movement. And ever since I began that work, I have always kept track of incidences I heard in which animals were injured, as well as women. And in fact, it's given the category, put under the category of psychological battering, the injury of, say, this couch or an animal sitting on the couch, that those were both ways of a batterer to try to reach and get control over a battered woman. I think feminist for animal rights is an excellent example of one kind of ecofeminist activism, bringing together an analysis about women and animals and then doing something about it, saying we can stop eating them, we can stop experimenting on them, we can stop wearing them, and we can care about battered women, we can care about women in the slaughterhouse business. It brings it together and it acts on it.
In the US, Canada, India, and across the globe, ecofeminists have fought against massive logging and clear cutting. In Northern California, Judy Berry has worked as an Earth First activist to save the old growth redwoods and to raise awareness about the position of women within the environmental movement.
The most representative sustained group of actions was called the Avian Uprising, or I guess is called, because we're going to be out there again this year,
And the Albion Uprising occurred in 1992 when Louisiana Pacific tried to cut one of the last remaining relatively intact watersheds in our area. We actually developed in particular one women's tactic there that was explicitly developed as a women's tactic. We had a Solstice Women's Gallery and we talked about why are there not more women in these demonstrations compared, even though there were a lot of women, but not compared to the population. And we discussed the fact that, well, women can't just show up, they have to get child care and, you know, can't risk arrest because they have to be to work the next day to take care of their kids. So we talked about it and we came up with, just specifically answering those needs, this tactic that was called yarning. And what we do is we take yarn and we go out at night so you can get child care and you can, you know, everything raises a very low arrest risk. And we weave it in and out and in and out and in and out of the trees. And it may not sound like much, but it turned out to be a really slow them down. And all these tactics only slow them down, they don't stop them. And because when they come in and try to cut it with their chainsaw, the yarn wraps around the chainsaw and stalls the chainsaw out. And if they try to whack it with their logger's axe, which is always their next thing, the logger's axe bounces off. And actually the most efficient and aggressively non-macho way to get rid of a web is to cut it with the scissors. But they won't do that. They use their knives instead, which takes longer. So yarning just became our symbol. We yarn everything. I mean, everything you could think of, even if we block a truck in the middle of the road, we yarn the truck. So it totally became a symbol of the Albion Uprising, and along with the developed mythology, we said to the loggers when they were getting ready to cut it, we said that when this is the web of life, and when the web is cut, the spell is cast. And so, you know, just little things like that to freak them out.
Recognizing the life-giving importance of diversity in both human cultures and ecosystems alike, ecofeminists have opposed the use of biotechnology and genetically engineered foods and been active in the movement for sustainable agriculture.
In my own region, the Garhwal area of the Himalaya, where the Chipko movement, this movement will stop logging, took place, I started working about 3-4 years ago on conserving native seed. And at that point, I really thought that it was just the conservation aspects. If I could achieve that, that would be wonderful. I think in about 3 valleys that I had looked at, there were 2 varieties of local seeds left.
Healthy ecosystems are needed to sustain human health, as ecofeminists working in the anti-toxics movement have found. Many kinds of cancers can now be directly traced to modern production processes which have detrimental effects on human and animal reproductive systems alike.
All right, the women's environmental health movement, which I'd say I'm a part of, is part of the ecofeminist movement. And that if you're going to talk about every aspect of society that's causing the demise of the earth and everything else, you have to also talk about health, because healthy societies is, in essence, what we're all trying to achieve, society and ecosystems. Breast cancer is an ecofeminist issue. And I'm a young woman, like I said last night, I'm 26. Many people tell me this isn't my issue. It is my issue, because 1 in 9, 1 in 8 of my sisters are going to die of it. By the year 2000, over 1 million women will die of cancer, breast cancer, every year, worldwide. And I want to talk about breast cancer as a gynocidal and ecocidal epidemic and crisis. That a lot of what Nestor said about, you know, genetics is focusing, the focus on genetics is distracting away from the reality that the human body is part and parcel and interconnected with the earth body.
There's a variety of actions ecofeminists are taking to raise awareness, build networks, and make changes. But individual changes in our personal lives are only one step toward the real solution of social, cultural, and economic transformation.
And I think one of the dangerous things that comes out of environmentalism more generally is this individualistic kind of perspective, that somehow if you tell your child to turn off the lights, you're saving the world. Well, in fact, militarism, multinational corporations, capitalism, those forces are operating to destroy women, to destroy animals, and to destroy the environment. So obviously these are the forces that need to be challenged.
Even if the individual civilian consumer stopped driving now, for instance, it would not make a significant dent in global warming. That the military-industrial complex, which is very much welded to the corporate structure, is responsible for creating the majority of, say, CFCs in the atmosphere. That the majority of toxins that are produced are not by Joe, Josephine, consumer, citizen. It's produced by this monolithic, huge structure called military-industrial complex and corporations. And that the problem is that if we think for a second that we as individuals created this, or that we as individuals can solve this, the game is over because they have won. Because what they want, what the power structures want, is for us to think that it's our fault, and that we as this big guilty complex, or this big guilty conscience, focus all of our energy on ourselves rather than pointing our fingers and saying, hey, you know, the military, hey, capitalism, hey, corporations, you know, what kind of economic system is creating this mess, and what kind of economic system do we have to recreate to get rid of this mess?
One of the great promises of ecofeminism is that it does allow us to see the matrix of forms of oppression that come about as a result of race, gender, species, so on.
I found that ecofeminism was really speaking more of the whole, the totality of the picture. It understood racism, classism, sexism, speciesism, and yet it also understood spirituality and an understanding of who we are as a species prior to the arrival of patriarchy.
Ecofeminists have crafted a multi-layered analysis of the problems we face as a culture, along with a reconstructive vision and a variety of action strategies for achieving that vision. Yet, often it seems the changes come too slowly.
And so often we think of transformation as something that's just this dramatic act that comes out of nowhere. And I think that really social change comes about very slowly and piecemeal over a period of time. There's a whole period of time where you're laying the groundwork for social change.
We have this mentality of thinking that the real change is going to be in the headlines, and it's going to be, you know, it's not these quiet changes, and I think a lot of quiet changes are in fact happening all over the place.
To keep going forward, this gradual process of social transformation requires a diversity of perspectives at every step of the way. Coalitions between women of all colors and sexualities must be built and maintained, both within ecofeminism and across the various movements for social change. Only if we can remember and respect our differences will we achieve our shared goals of social and ecological justice.
One thing that I learned, I think, out of the experience of the Woman Earth Institute, which was that it's really crucial that, you know, for a movement which is in some way trying to be about a conversation, you know, among and between women in particular, with respect to a whole range of issues, that there be a diversity of women present, you know. So, I mean, I think, you know, see the necessity of that, and also the difficulty of it, and the level of commitment that really is required.
We need to begin to develop very concrete coalitions, and they cannot be coalitions just developed at the level of one-shot conferences, so that one goes to Beijing and comes back and reports. It has to be coalitions built on action, coalitions built over years, coalitions built on face-to-face encounters between peoples throughout the world.
I also see the combination of feminism and ecology as as a solidarity between two of the most important movements of our time.
At the end there, because I got this video in this spring in time to show to my ecological ethics class, and we were pressed for time, so I started to turn the video off just as the credits were coming on, and they all yelled at me and said, "We want to see how the pot turned out. We want to see how." So I had to turn it back on, and it also gives the music. That's fine. No, anybody else needs to walk out or get some air. Yeah.
Do you know anything more about the Judy Berry explosion and injury? What are the? Do they think this was corporate interests?
Have any of you been living in areas where Earth First has been active and doing actions? Yeah. I mean, this has developed into a very, very difficult, conflictive. Angry confrontation at times between Earth First activists and logging corporations, and oftentimes very personalized between the activists and the loggers. And as far as I know, it's still in the courts. I don't know if anybody else has further information on that. But I do remember the situation when it happened, when she's been very involved for years in Earth First activities, and when the pipe bomb was placed in her car and blown up. I don't know that they have pinpointed exactly who was responsible. Does anyone else have that information? It's part of what is a reality in terms of environmental issues. There's a lot of conflict built in, and there are a lot of vested interests on lots of different sides of it in terms of what happens when people begin to take seriously some responsibility for, as the song said, defending the earth, and it runs against other interests. I think the logging thing is a very difficult situation because you've got extremely large corporate interests, but you also have real individuals and families who may have two or three or four generations of living in an area and being involved in logging, and that how do you begin to move towards ecological sustainability, but also respect those individuals, their families, their need to make a livelihood, and those kind of difficult issues.
Yeah. We found on Whidbey Island that there are logging trucks rolling off the island, and many times there are the larger corporations that have come in and just take the logs and leave, and that we can have better conversations with local loggers who want to get into sustainable logging, and some of them who have done it through some generations. Yeah. So we're finding some progress there.
Yeah, I think there are some real positive signs, but that's a very challenging issue, particularly people who live in the Northwest here. And part of what gets missed oftentimes in the media discussion of it is long before the spotted owl controversy came to a head, corporations were already beginning to abandon large areas. They've moved to the Southeast. I've spent a lot of time in the Southern Hemisphere in Chile. The temperate forests of South America are being just wiped out, mostly going to Japan, but also coming some to North America. And so when Kaya Heller was talking there about needing to constantly get past looking at just individuals, but to think about what are the corporate and the government, the military interests behind a lot of these interactions, I think that's an important reminder. But I'd just be interested, we've got about 10 minutes or so, just some of your response to some of the ideas that came up. You see there's a great diversity of different perspectives and beliefs in there, unified in a few things. And let me just mention a couple comments, then we'll just go for yours there. I just want to put on the board, what's the problem? Deep ecology, which we looked at yesterday, said the problem is anthropocentrism, being human-centered. Social ecology, which we haven't looked at so much, says the problem is not so much anthropocentrism, but social hierarchy. When you create hierarchies of some people on top of other people, and then nature inevitably gets caught up in that hierarchy at the bottom. Ecofeminism, I think, deepens both of those to say it's not only human-centeredness, but male-centeredness that has constructed many of our cultures. And part of the problem is that hierarchy has become both gendered and naturalized, both gendered and naturalized. I thought it was fascinating when Barbara Rossi was leading the Bible study this morning, we looked at the 1 Corinthians 11, chapter 11, which talked about the reasons why men and women have to wear different clothes, because woman comes from man, although biologically it's exactly the opposite in terms of nature. Anybody who's a man was born out of a woman, but somehow that they hierarchized woman coming from man, and they created a gendered hierarchy. And nature and women oftentimes are in subordinate positions. So that's part of the really important thing of ecofeminism. In response to that, ecofeminism develops what they call a kinship ethic, that we are all interconnected in kin, and use the values of care and compassion along with justice is what needs to be taking place there. And I think really balancing individual moral worth with the holistic vision as well, saying both of those are important to keep in tension there. But what are some of the things that you responded to that you either liked or disliked or were confused about in the video? It's hard for me to see folks upstairs, so if you've got something you want to say, yell out, because you're in the dark for me there.
The scattering of efforts impressed me. I kept thinking, I know this is the way things go, and you have to do what you can do where you are, but it's very frustrating and discouraging that groups not only sometimes don't know about each other, but may not have the impulse to coordinate the efforts if they do know about each other, and so the efforts get quite fragmented.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very helpful comment. One of the things that excited me about this video when I first watched it was the diagram of the feminism range that showed the many different mountains, each one of them contributing a stream to an overall lake. That's, I think, in some ways a very positive, optimistic image. that doesn't always reflect the kind of conflict there has between many of these different groups. Particularly, they mention the divide between groups that focus more on spiritual, cultural, religious change, and groups that focus more on political, economic, social change. And yet, increasingly, I think that these groups are recognizing they have to talk to each other. This conference in 1994, out of which this video came, shows some of the real important efforts of beginning to speak to each other and recognizing valid points in there. You won't hear so much anymore, for example, the standard old line that, you know, from the Marxist line, that religion is always the opiate of the masses. And that's because particularly women of color, Native American women, African American women, women in Asia. I mean, I remember we had a Hispanic feminist activist come to Drake this year, and she said atheism is white privilege. And if you're in a community of color, you can't afford to be atheist. We depend on our religion, our spirituality, to get by day to day. You have to have economic privilege, everything else, to afford to be an atheist. But I think the voices of women of color saying it's a false divide to say spirituality is one thing and politics is another. They have to hold them together. Mary?
The other divide that they didn't address, that from what I saw coming in a little late, is class.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really huge divide within this whole movement.
Yeah.
And that would be the only thing that kind of disturbs me about a film like this, is that you see mostly over-educated, but highly educated. You know, the fact that they interviewed so many of these women in front of bookshelves, I thought was really a kind of interesting thing. And that it would have been nice to see more women, like, in their workplace, or mothers with kids, or that kind of thing. It did look like a middle-class, upper-middle-class, more intellectually privileged.
In some ways, it sort of reflects almost the image of the early feminism in the sort of the 70s period, when it was seen at least publicly or visually as a more of a white middle class movement. And I think there's two things to say about that. I think it's an accurate critique. I think it's also a somewhat accurate reflection about where ecofeminism is. I would say that the two areas that really needs to be challenged are in race and class. And they acknowledge race in there, but there were few women of color who actually spoke. Although there were, Winona LaDuc is very active from Native American, and Lourdes Arguelles has been in the United Farm Workers spoken there, is working on that. But that's been, I think, in just the last few years, where people, there was a comment that said that ecofeminism is trying to bring together feminism, anti-racism work, and ecology, those three. And those are not necessarily natural constituencies. The other one I wish I would have liked to have seen addressed much more here, but it's again a more recent one that's developing, is the whole movement called environmental racism, that is really focusing on how communities of color become the depositories for toxic waste in our country. I mean, some of the I work with my students on this, and some of these are absolutely astonishing. When you look at nuclear waste depositories, 13 out of the 16 major nuclear waste depositories in this country are either on or adjacent to Native American reservation lands. When you look at how many Native Americans actually benefit from nuclear power, virtually none. I mean, you look at the Navajo reservation, where most of them don't even have electricity, and yet the uranium mines, the coal firing plants, these kind of things. So environmental racism is a big, big issue that's increasingly both in rural and in urban areas being paid attention to. And you start to see some of it in there, but not enough, I think, from my perspective.
I had a rather embarrassing and personal reaction to something that surprises me. I am thinking and believing things that 10 years ago I would have thought, and learning things that I would have thought unthinkable. And it has to do more with a spiritual awareness of wholeness of life and justice and injustice, I guess. This is new to me, a lot of this. But I'm becoming aware of the conditioning of my culture in my embarrassment at the radicalness of these women.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that feeling, but I'm afraid that it's going to cause it to be unpalatable and ineffective. I mean, not capable of doing it, because I'm afraid it's going to put women off who are also afraid of that. I'm not saying I think those people should change. I'm saying I need to, but how wide is the gap between these women and the mother that flips pancakes on Friday morning.
Well, you know, you bring a couple of things I think are really important issues on this. And one of them was they tried to address a little bit early on in the video when they said there are a lot of women who are doing ecofeminism but don't identify themselves as ecofeminists precisely for those reasons. They see this too wacky, too radical, too crazy, whatever. And I think that's a really important issue, that it, when the terms begin to get in the way of the work, get rid of the terms, not the work. I mean, if you're working in your own neighborhood or whatever kind of struggle you are to and to do things that are more environmentally sound, don't use jargon that's going to alienate people. You know, come and say, look, this is our neighborhood, and they want to put, you know, they want to put pesticides dumping here. Let's stop them. You don't have to say I'm an ecofeminist. But the second thing was that I think Mary pointed out, I think would have also helped this video. Now, on behalf of this video, I want to say Greta Gard, who put this video together, basically put this together out of her own pocket, because she said there's got to be some way to start putting this, getting this message out further. And I think, frankly, given the resources she had, she did a really admirable job. But another thing that would have helped a lot, I think, would have been what Mary's pointing out, not only to show women in their workplaces, but also to show more the examples of local struggles, where women are, you know, fighting to have a playground or a green space in a park, or where, you know, not only women, but people coalition together. So you start to get the variety of ideas of the, not just the theory, but the different actions that people are doing. Because that's what I find, frankly, exciting about this movement. It really is a grassroots movement. It's just all sorts of different folks. If you remember about 10 years ago when Love Canal in New York burst out, where they had built this new housing property over a former toxic waste site. Well, that was Lois Gibbs and a group of suburban neighborhood women who got angry. They didn't call themselves ecofeminists, but they were women who were concerned about their kids, concerned about their lives, concerned about their neighborhood, and they started writing letters. So that's precisely the point. There can be some degree of which, you know, if I get involved in this, well, I end up like, I love Kai Heller, who is the one I think it kind of, sort of, I heard some people laughing, and, you know, she can sound like she's sort of going off the deep end about the 99%, the 1%, stuff like that. But if you step back from the kind of the emotion of the rhetoric, I think there's a lot of truth in her analysis. How do we make that more accessible to people so people can hear that? Yeah. Yeah, Chris?
Something I missed that I thought would be interesting to see is a little more delving into the long history of connecting women and nature and how that connection has happened historically. Like an example I can think of immediately is the way that America was drawn in early pictures when this country was being settled, and most often America was drawn as a naked woman reclining and very sexualized, and there are these fully dressed either pilgrims or explorers with swords and you know, their full regalia standing over America, who's reclining in a hammock kind of like this, you know. And that kind of a connection, I think, can show the long-term history that they're trying to draw attention to.
One of my favorite eco-feminist writers, she wasn't in this video, but if any of you are interested in that, a woman named Carolyn Merchant, who teaches in the Bay Area, she has a book called The Death of Nature, Women, Gender, and the Modern Era. And she, what she analyzes is that the linkages of these images and the fact that we've had nature has been imaged for at least the last couple thousand years, both as Mother Earth, as this feminized, beneficent, giving thing, but also as the wild whore. The voluptuous, seductive woman that has to be strapped down, has to be tamed, has to be, you know, subdued in order for male culture, male civilization to be able to thrive. And you know, for many years, the Mother Earth imagery was a restraint on exploitation, but that began to change rapidly in the modern era when they shifted from the Mother Earth imagery much more to the nature as the wild woman, who's threatening and therefore has to be tamed, and Francis Bacon in particular. And so there are some excellent historical studies that show the linkage between women and nature and how that's functioned in society.
Is one of those Keller, I'm not sure I've got the right, the women and science
thing? Yeah, Evelyn Scott, Evelyn Fox Keller as well. Women science and women, gender and science, I forget the exact title, but Keller as well. And there's a wonderful bookstore in the, wonderful book in the bookstore, also the library, although I think it's checked out right now, by Rosemary Ruther, a Christian feminist theologian, called Gaia and God, Ecofeminist Theology. And she does the same thing looking at the Christian, the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's a marvelous book if any of you are interested in delving more into this and how she looks at what are the possibilities. She was the one I talked about who said, if we want Christians to take this seriously, and there are 1 billion Christians or self-identified Christians in the world, we have to find a way to make these issues intelligible to people in the Christian tradition. And I think she has a very helpful start on that.
To go back to the issue raised by your feeling of being embarrassed by the stridency or the passion, perhaps, or the lack of kind of connection to the real issues that we face as middle class people, it reminds me of theology of the cross and how odd theology of the cross appears to us middle class folks as well. I mean, why did Jesus have to die on the cross? I mean, all we really needed was to know that God loved us and and all the blood and gore and suffering is something that the church tends to lose a grip on. It tends to relinquish that because what we're looking for is a kind of congregational church that's supportive and does some nice stuff in its neighborhood and whatnot. But the cross itself is too big a symbol. It's too radical a symbol. It's too rich a symbol. I mean, it's got too much power for us. We don't need it, and so we kind of let it slip away. And I think there's a similar parallel here. The early Christians needed that symbol because of the way in which their desire to show God's love was running smack into the Roman emperor, smack into the church at the time, the Pharisees and whatnot. I mean, they were getting no headway whatsoever. In fact, their minuscule efforts to be kind to one another and to accept slaves and, you know, whatever, was getting them killed. It was remarkable. And so what I see these feminist speakers as speaking out of the same kind of amazement and passion that the little, they want to save a couple trees and they get fucking blown up.
Yeah.
You know? They get blown up. What's going on here? And that's why it's so passionate.
Yeah.
You know, it's so passionate because all of a sudden, when you turn against the system, you are suddenly walking on water, and it's very scary and it's very threatening. And I think the church needs to come back with the theology of the cross and say that God is walking. It's the same thing with African Americans. Yeah. I mean, it's the reason that they turned to religion, the reason that their religion was so life-giving and is life-giving to us, it's because, I don't know, I can't put it into words, but you know what I'm getting at?
Well, I think that, and I'll maybe close with this, we need to close, but that's for me why holding the spiritual and the other parts to it are so important, because if you think of in your own life, when you are grabbed spiritually by something and it won't let you go, that's when you're willing to be at risk being embarrassed. I mean, you don't even really have any choice. It just becomes who you are. And I think part of what I'm seeing going on in ecological ethics is people really are being grasped by our interconnectedness. Alice Walker says, you know, in The Color Purple, there's a wonderful section. I probably should have read it at some point. I just love it. But when she comes to revision God in there, Celie and Sugar talking, she says, I finally realized that if I cut a tree, my arm would bleed. Mm-hmm. When you really begin to realize that this earth is part of who we are and part of God's, what God has created all together, when you get gripped by that, then, you know, that's where the passion comes in. It can also, you know, bring in a little militancy, but hey, you know, we've survived that before. I hope those of you have had a chance, I hope it's been a good week for you. I love talking about this stuff, so grab me a coffee break or over meals.